Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents A Darker Wilderness, Black Nature Writing from Soil to Stars. Edited by Aaron Sharkey. Narrated by Carmen Jewel Jones. This is how the past interrupts our lives, all of it entering the same doorway, like the hole in the trunk of my neighbor's tree. At once a natural shelter, haven for small creatures, but also evidence of injury, an entrance for decay. Natasha Trethewey, Monument, Poems New and Selected. Every generation confronts the task of choosing its past. Inheritances are chosen as much as they are passed on. The past depends less on what happened then than on the desires and discontents of the present. Strivings and failures shape the stories we tell. Sadia Hartman, Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route. Things become bearers of memory and information, especially when enhanced by stories that expand their capacity to carry meaning. Tia Miles, All That She Carried, The Journey of Ashley's Sack, A Black Family Keepsake. Forward, Memory Divine, Carolyn Finney. Blackness is not one or 1,000 things. Reginald Dwayne Betts, New York Times. It is dangerous to be discovered. Alexis Pauline Gumbs, Undrowned. See me, feel me, touch me, heal me. The Who. What saith the woman who lies in green pastures that are not her own? What songs does she sing? What sound do her fingers make as she tends the garden of some other dream? Does she notice the withered skin, a reflection of a soul that has been forsaken? Does she sense the heaviness of a heart forced to bear a load it did not create? What saith the woman who lies in green pastures that are not her own? When do we become a memory? If you do not remember us, do we cease to exist? I recently read an article by author and critic Seth Rodney about the African-American artist Jennifer Packer and her recent exhibition at the Whitney Museum entitled Jennifer Packer, The Eye Is Not Satisfied with Seeing. According to Rodney, we experience a seesawing between observation and imagination, as Packer simultaneously highlights and obscures the nuances of black life, exploring longing, loss, and wonderment while honoring the named and unnamed. Her paintings, he argues, demand that we look by losing a color or a body part or even a person by what they include and exclude, by forcing the viewer to complete the piece's visual and emotional puzzle. What is my responsibility to see? Asks Rodney. Who will hold us accountable when we fail in this very basic duty? I felt like he was talking to me. For the past 19 years, I've been telling the story of my parents on the land in juxtaposition to a narrative of nature that has not and does not always see them, a narrative of environmental longing and belonging that has neglected to consider a darker wilderness. I've been telling the story of a black experience with all things green, colored by an American history of extraction, exploitation, and erasure, in a country where love of land and of each other could cost you. And yet, you love anyway. There is a black and white photograph of my mother. It is 1958, and she is kneeling by a pond on a 12-acre property in New York that she and my father will never own, but that will become their legacy. My parents left their home in Virginia, a southern state that could not see past their black skin in any way that mattered, and traveled to New York to find jobs and perhaps a place that might welcome them as whole beings with dreams and potential. They left behind a past that was filled not only with the pain of limitations forced on them by others, but with family, the familiar, and the memories that had stoked their dreams. My father was offered a job as a gardener and chauffeur for a wealthy family who needed full-time caretakers to live on their estate, and he accepted the position. For the next 50 years, my parents would be the only black people to live in that affluent neighborhood, and, to my knowledge, the only people there who did not own the land they called home. When I stare at the picture of my mother kneeling in the sun in this new place for the first time, this home but not home, I wonder if she was seeking her own reflection in the pond. I wonder if she felt as though she was drowning in a life that she did not recognize, in a life that she did not know how to know. I know now that she was melancholy. As I look at the photograph, I wonder if I am, as painter Donna Nelson suggests in the exhibition catalog for Packard's show, in the presence of a person on the threshold of absence. What saith the woman who lies in green pastures that are not her own? There is another photograph I keep on my desk of my parents in 2003, standing on this very same estate, older and grayer, but still upright and resolute. They are standing in the sun, in front of a weeping cherry tree that my father gave my mother to celebrate their 40th wedding anniversary. As I look at this photo, I am reminded of Gordon Parks's American Gothic, a black-and-white photograph of Ella Watson, black mother and worker, holding a broom and mop upright and resolute in front of the American flag. The symmetry between the two photographs is not lost on me. Their blackness and wholeness in the face of an American history that has never embraced them on their terms. Upright and resolute. Their love and labor exploited, overlooked, and shunted to the background of a narrative that strains to ignore what it does not wish to understand. I scrutinize the photo more closely, squinting as though blurring the edges might focus my sight. This was the last photo ever taken of my parents, on the land they called home for nearly 50 years. The owners had passed away, and the new owner snapped this shot of them in front of the cherry tree they could not take back to Virginia, where a new home was being constructed, but which would be a reminder of their presence on the land. I examine the photo for signs of, well, for signs of what? Of impending loss? Of accomplishment? Of readiness? Of acceptance? Of wholeness? Am I looking for signs of myself? What saith the woman who lies in green pastures that are not her own? For 18 years, no one from my family went back to visit the land. We tried once, unsuccessfully, to get access, but were surprised to discover that a large, locked, wrought iron gate now blocked public entry. I felt like a kid peering through a window, seeing my past self reflected, faded like in a dream, staring back, waiting. I wanted to fling open those gates, not only to let us in, but to let our memories out. I wanted to shout our presence to the sky. We are here! I wanted to run down the driveway I used to pretend was a river of piranhas, part of the imaginary world I constructed as a child. I wanted to see my father tending the flower beds, rich with zinnias, tulips, and snapdragons, all vying for his attention. I wanted to feel my mother's eyes on my brothers and I as we played on the swing set and rolled down the hill, getting leaves in our kinky hair. I wanted to touch the rocks and grass and trees that told us who we were, despite the noise from the outside world. I wanted to remember. What saith the woman who lies in green pastures that are not her own? Home has always been an overwhelmingly enticing, all-consuming, magnificent idea for me. As someone who was adopted as a baby, I struggle with the weight of the word. To me, it implies a sense of ownership, of claiming, of belonging, of recognition, of relationship, of being claimed, of being wanted, of being seen, of knowing, which I have found, in part, elusive. After I eagerly left home at 18, it was a place I returned to with feelings of both desire and trepidation. This home was where my parents, who raised me, resided, and also where I found out that I was not biological kin. This home was where I looked for myself everywhere, every day, and came up wanting. This home was filled with contradictions that I'm still wading through in an effort to make sense of, well, everything. But this home was also the only place that I knew I could return to and be welcomed. I cannot say that I thought, at the time, that the land was extra special or exceptional, except that it was. But it was the only place in my life that felt like a certainty, a kind of North Star in a world that did not know how to see me, and that I did not know how to see. For better and for worse, I became myself on that land. So many firsts happened there. Experiencing loss, falling in love, being denied, wrestling with anger, feeling humiliation, facing fear and losing, facing fear and winning, creating new worlds, and dreaming, so much dreaming. Daydreaming wasn't just something I did on the land. It was a state of mind, a state of being. It was an out-of-body experience that somehow occurred within my own brown body. And that body became something more, too. As I ran, swam, biked, and climbed my way through a life I wasn't sure I had earned, but was desperate to prove myself worthy of. And all the while, as I dreamed and flew, my parents toiled in the background, their own dreams fading as their children grew. By the time my parents left our home in 2003, I had moved at least 12 times and had spent the better part of 5 years backpacking in Africa and Asia, ultimately finding respite in a village in Nepal for a year and a half. By 2003, I had pursued an acting career for 11 years and returned to school, where I ultimately completed 3 degrees. By 2003, I had married and divorced and married and divorced again. By 2003, I had become so practiced at throwing my heart out into the world in my search for a home that I almost didn't notice that I was about to lose the only home I had ever known. As my parents were getting their picture taken in front of their cherry tree, I was working on my doctorate and looking for stories about black people and nature on the library shelves and coming up wanting. Again, as I watched the story of my parents on that land fading to black, I decided to tell a different story. It was time to hold myself accountable. In the summer of 2021, those iron gates opened. The murder of George Floyd in the streets by a police officer and the weaponization of Christian Cooper's skin against him as he birdwatched in Central Park became the latest entries in an encyclopedia of truths, stories, and moments about black experience in the American landscape that would be denied no longer. Memories of who we've been, which had been shoved deep into the dirt, exploded in a riot of color and ferociousness no one could ignore, though many tried. We had to say their names, past and present, and in every sector of society. And it implicated everybody, including me. In this moment of sharing stories and telling truths, I had an opportunity to return to that land I had called home, and I grabbed that moment with both hands, with desire and trepidation, and with hope. It was one of those too hot New York summer days. The thermometer hovered around 95 degrees Fahrenheit. I was wearing a white silk dress, in part because of the heat, but I think that I also needed to feel light, like I was floating through an experience that I might otherwise emotionally drown in. My visit was not a private affair. In this moment of remembering, organizations, institutions, and individuals with the power to forget were on their own journeys. And for some, this translated into showing up for a story they did not know how to know, but that they could feel. Our group was a small, motley crew made up of institutional representatives, academics, documentary filmmakers, artists, friends, and a forester. And perhaps, most importantly, one of the new owners whose family now called this place home. What saith the woman who lies in green pastures that are not her own? It's almost 1 year later, and I am still processing my visit home. I felt overwhelmed by the presence of my past reflected on the grass like sunlight on a lake. I was everywhere. My family was everywhere. And though the place had changed, it was no longer tended to daily. Trees had been cut down. Rocks were covered with moss, and tulips and zinnias no longer greeted you from the flower beds along the driveway. We were no less present. I kept holding my breath, afraid to exhale, lest I unleash a torrent of emotion I was not ready to share. Not everyone deserves our truth. But there was a moment. As part of our visit, we paid homage to the cherry tree, which had been unceremoniously cut down years ago. We had collectively decided to plant a new weeping cherry tree, and we watched as the forester dug a hole for it. He never complained, even though the heat was stifling, and he treated the new tree with such care, patiently explaining what it needed and why we were planting it in the spot he had chosen. When he called me over to put the new tree in the ground, and I could feel all eyes on me, I was nearly overcome with emotion. As I held the tree, I could feel our collective exhale. In that moment, I understood that this story was no longer only mine or my family's. It belonged to all of us. I eagerly await the release of the documentary film so I can view all this from another angle. How do others see our story? I have been focused for almost 2 decades on the story of my family and their love of the land that was never theirs, but I have to ask, what of the absences? What am I not seeing? That land has been home to so many others. What of my indigenous sisters and brothers? What of the non-human species that hold forth daily? What of the trees that reach for the skies? As the essays in this collection show, their presence and our presence is everywhere. For my family, our presence is embedded in the absence of flower beds, of pink hydrangeas, of apple trees, in the memories held by the land of me and my brothers foraging in the woods, rolling in the leaves, and playing in the snow. The echoes of our presence can be felt in our absence, in the erasure and negligence with which we are all too familiar. Here's what I know. We are undeniable because we are part of a larger story of place and time, because the before and after always has us in between, because we are dust to dust, because to know a thing is to love a thing, and we love deeply. And because all of our stories are in relationship, I am because you are. upright and resolute. And the land remembers, even if we do not. For as the earth breathes, so do we, because this is our home. Introduction. More to be shaped by. Aaron Sharkey. So much nature writing is about freedom and access to the vast spaces that provide crisp air and opportunities for fresh perspectives. But this collection's origins lie in a revelation that came to me while teaching nature writing in a prison setting, where participants didn't have access to such liberative experiences. I began teaching in prisons in 2016, after years of activism in response to the violences of the injustice system. I'd always preferred teaching in non-traditional classrooms and found that the best education happens between students across differences, whether in race, age, or socioeconomic experience. This is exactly the kind of teaching that happens in prison classrooms, and beneath this motivation, I felt an unanswered desire to understand my long-absent father, who was incarcerated for a time when I was a child. I taught classes from memoir to lyric essay in prisons before answering a call for a new class offering and proposing a 15-week nature writing class for Minnesota's largest facility, a former mental hospital in the southern part of the state. I began teaching in the waning days of summer. During the class, we marked the way nature transcended the walls of the institution. On the first day, a blaze orange fox ran across our path to the education building. Over the length of the course, an old-growth aspen grew unbounded, peeling its curling bark, shedding its browning leaves, holding the first snowflakes on heavy branches. The writers moved through their days on a schedule, imposed by a crackling voice over a loudspeaker, but they also watched birds gliding freely past the windows, industrious yellow jackets throwing their bodies against the glass, and a flock of mallards who navigated puddles in the yard, ignoring the guards watching from their towers. The course spanned the entire fall, from September, when the light stretches long into the evenings, to December, when the students craned their necks to mark the waxing moon as they made their way back to their units. Students remembered summer trips out west, cliff jumping in Oregon, dust storms while serving in the military, working the farm as boys, and favorite winding riverside drives. Nature was a meeting place for writers with very different backgrounds. They were black and white, Hmong and Anishinaabe. Some grew up in the city, some in the country, some on the reservation, some were from Minnesota, and some were from faraway places. Over those weeks, the 15 students remembered nature's power to teach us about ourselves, to help us connect with others, to mark time and its passing, to regain perspective. And I learned from them that nature can shape our lives, even in unnatural conditions like those experienced by the incarcerated. Even in those confines, nature was present and worth observing. I grew up in the Twin Cities, between St. Paul and Minneapolis, the city of lakes. I shook sand out of my shoes nearly every evening of the summer, evidence of days spent on the city's beaches. A golden tan bloomed on my brown skin, my nose and forehead freckled. I marked years this way. Summers were like this. Kids from our Southside United Methodist Church crammed into a retired Bluebird bus, learning about the Bible and praising Jesus in nature under high pines and on the shores of the state's 10,000 lakes. The fall, a blaze of red and orange, tornado drills. The spring, lilacs and lilies of the valley. Floods. The winter, dozens of varieties of snow. Knowledge that the coldest days are the ones with the clearest, widest skies. All of this was natural. Each summer of my childhood, my family loaded up our maroon minivan and embarked on a road trip. The varied landscapes of North America flew by my window in a blur. For weeks at a time, we made our home in a clearing, slept in our big, gray, 5-person Columbia tent, and set up our kitchen and dining room on a long picnic table and around a fire pit in plain view of our new temporary neighbors. This public expression of our familial cadence, out in the open, welcomed questions about our racial makeup. 2 white parents, my mom and my stepdad, my tow-headed little brother, the baby adopted from Guatemala, and me, a big-boned, mixed-race black girl. Across the nation, I met other kids exploring the woods and lazy streams in national parks and wildernesses. They were white and curious. The inescapable questions: are you black? Why aren't you with your real parents? I learned that nature is not a place where you can escape the oppressive rules of race. I learned that I had access to natural spaces because of my parents' privilege and resources, their jobs as a teacher and a bureaucrat, their time off in the summer, their own experiences with travel as children, and because of their race, which granted them comfort in the wilderness, in spaces like those campgrounds, in rural areas of this country. In my prison nature writing class, we started with the basics. Born in the 18th century, nature writing grew out of an effort to describe and categorize the attributes of birds, animals, and insects, a list that grew as more of the world was discovered. This discovery was violent because it was a tool of colonization, with explorers conquering new land, and with it, nature that was unfamiliar to them. Natural history museums also flourished during this time. They often featured human specimens, particularly indigenous peoples, as well as plants and animals. The grave-robbed remains of 22 Inuit endured in the archives of Chicago's Field Museum until 2011, when they were returned to the Inuit Taparit Kanatami in Labrador. The San Diego Museum of Man displayed human remains until 2012. The hierarchy of colonization is reproduced within natural history in the sorting of some humans as subjects rather than scientists. The work of empire, conquering and cataloging, is the field in which nature writing emerges, making its appearance in response to conditions of the state: industrialization, capitalism, urbanization, democracy. One of the trademarks of the genre is that it is rooted in first-person observation, so it is vital to investigate the identities of those observers. Let's consider Henry David Thoreau, one of the central figures of the field. Before Thoreau set out to live deliberately, he had ample leisure time and resources to imagine the Walden Pond Project. He embarked on Independence Day of 1845 for the 2-year, 2-month, and 2-day experiment. He had just been released from a brief stay in jail, having been arrested for failure to pay poll taxes in protest of slavery and the Mexican-American War. His debt was paid by a family member. The land his cottage was built on was owned by his friend, Ralph Waldo Emerson. Students in the nature writing class noted the similarity of Thoreau's 10-by-15 cottage to the size of the cells they occupied. And the genre remains dominated by white, cisgender men with access to resources. Thoreau's Walden was followed by Audubon's Trees and Darwin's Finches, which were then followed over the following century by Burroughs' Trout, Leopold's Gray Owl, Abbey's Desert, and Pollen's Farm, men who moved toward conservation. Their female counterparts considered nature and the body. Rachel Carson, Terry Tempest Williams, and Annie Dillard invited readers to consider the environmental impacts of development and the ways our spirituality can form in relationship to nature. Just as the ways we experience nature in this country are not isolated from our identities, nature writing is not neutral.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?